The Takeaway is supported by Netflix original documentary series Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis. The series explores sex and technology in a digital age. Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, April 26, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Blaming Canada. Big joke on South Park, maybe.
Canada's been very rough in the United States. Everyone thinks of Canada as being wonderful, and so do I. I love Canada. But they've outsmarted our politicians for many years.
But blaming Canada is not such a big joke around here. We're broadcasting again today from WBFO in Buffalo, New York, just down the road from the Peace Bridge that connects this community to neighboring Canada. Since we stopped trying to annex the country with the Treaty of Washington in 1871, there has been peace and more between our two countries. The value of trade between Canada and the U.S. is the second highest in the world, an estimated $662.7 billion in 2015, second only to the U.S. and China. Here, everything from tourists to hockey stars to commuters to immigrants and more crosses the Canada to Buffalo Peace Bridge. There have been trade disputes all along between the U.S. and Canada. Salmon, oil, dairy products, and forest products, among others. But now, a trade dispute with Canada looks to be the first serious trade crisis of the Trump presidency. The White House announced this week that in retaliation for Canadian dairy price drops, a roughly 20% tariff will be levied on Canadian softwood lumber. The decision affects more than $5.5 billion worth of imports of the material used to build houses in the United States. We asked Armin Yelnizian, economist and business commentator for the CBC, to respond to the White House charge that Canada moved first by dropping its dairy prices to undercut U.S. producers.
It's this increasing competitiveness of Canadian producers that made American product, which was already in oversupply, less competitive. And that's when these Wisconsin and Upper New York State dairy farmers lost their contracts with large dairy processors in New York State and in Wisconsin, and were kind of, there's 75 of them that had no place to ship their export milk. And as you know, milk is not like a bag of nails. You can't put it on a shelf in inventory. If you don't move it in 48 hours, you have to dump it. So it is a very significant issue for these 75 dairy farmers. But it isn't because we introduced some kind of a tariff on this product.
Well, but, you know, undercutting prices, raising prices. I'll take your point. And I love, you know, milk is not like a bag of nails. Yes, grasshopper. Yes, that is very, very wise, very true. But I'm wondering if, generally speaking, because Donald Trump has seemed to dispute and resist and, you know, expressed a kind of repulsion over trade deals that are broad, that, you know, stepping away from broad treaties and, you know, leaves the bilateral dispute open and is likely to inflame more bilateral disputes. And then we could be seeing with Canada and Mexico and a lot of countries in Asia as well. Generally speaking, looking at the trade deals around the world, do you think this Trump attitude opens and invites more bilateral disputes?
I think the Trump attitude is very much to posture that a deal is going to be made that is going to benefit Americans. So lots of small things become big things so that you can pick a fight and show some kind of a win in a narrow avenue, even if that win was going to take place anyway. But it's really interesting that in virtually all of the cases that we are talking about, the American position under the new president is adding costs to consumers. There's not one single thing that necessarily protects jobs. It may add a few hundred jobs here or there, but those measures largely are eclipsed by rising consumer prices. For example, the lack of agreement in softwood lumber is already pushing costs up for housing in the United States. And as you know, housing, it's been a long time coming that the market has been in a position where it has demand to meet by building new stock. The costs of building a home have risen by 22% because of this lack of agreement already. In Michigan, I have learned that it costs about another $3,600 per new house and has pushed about 9,000 potential buyers in Detroit out of the market because of higher costs.
Trying to look at it from your perspective now, and again, the idea of having a dispute with Canada does sort of strike at you know, one's intuition about U.S.-Canadian relations. I mean, we are close.
For sure.
There's a huge trade sharing that goes on, $600 billion or so. But I'm wondering if the strategy of the Trump administration, as far as we can tell, does invite countries to basically, well, if we don't know what's going on at the White House, we should take steps to protect our own businesses. And that's kind of what the dairy farmers have done in Canada. And we can expect such things from other nations as they contemplate what's going to come out of the White House.
Well, that's a fascinating approach, and I have to say that there's been a lot of quips online that the strategy of Blame Canada is straight out of a South Park movie, really. It's a live remake of it.
No, who would say that? Who would say such a thing?
But the truth is that we don't know where the president is going to end up. We don't know how much of this is posturing. And you raise a very important question that when faced with uncertainty, what is one's response? What is happening in Canada is increased competition to lower prices, make these products more viable on international markets. As you know, Canada just signed off on a Canada-Europe trade agreement, which will open up the Canadian markets to more European imports, but equivalently, dairy producers are getting ready to ship more to China. We just started China trade talks. So if the U.S. wants to play hardball, there are other markets in the world. We are very reliant, and we do have, as you point out, this incredibly close relationship, the most successful, long-standing trade relationship in the world, and the most fluid border in the world between two sovereign states. And it's also true that the United States enjoys a trade surplus in that relationship, which is passing strange, right? It even enjoys a trade surplus in dairy exports with Canada, right? So it's just one of those, why are you shooting yourself in the foot on this? Why don't we just negotiate a win-win for everybody? But we don't know that that won't be the ultimate outcome. This really is a president that loves show a lot more than go.
This dispute, I mean, is this going to be something we're going to see all through the Trump administration? Or, I mean, are you prepared for years of this, or is this a flash in the pan?
Oh, I don't think it's a flash in the pan. I think this is going to be the MO of this administration. And I think the fact that you don't have a nominee for trade representative yet confirmed means that every time there is this kind of blustering that China's the problem, that Mexico's the problem, that Canada's the problem, presents a problem for you, in the regard that the world places, that the U.S. is actually ready to do business. Protectionism is not doing business.
Speaking to us from Toronto in Canada, or what we like to say, North Park, Armin Yalnızyan is economist and business commentator for the CBC. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Do you fear a trade war with Canada, sir?
No, not at all.
Why not?
They have a tremendous surplus with the United States. Whenever they have a surplus, I have no fear. By the way, virtually every country has a surplus with the United States. We have massive trade deficits. So when we're the country with the deficits, we have no fear.
President Trump taking questions from reporters on Tuesday afternoon. Ambassador Ira Shapiro was the U.S. chief trade negotiator with Japan and Canada and general counsel in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative during the Clinton administration. He's currently a senior advisor at the Albright Stonebridge Group. Ambassador Shapiro, welcome to The Takeaway.
It's nice to be with you, John.
Do you take any issue, Ambassador, with our colleague from Canada on any of her claims of what's going on in this dispute?
Well, let me put it in context, John, and you touched on some of these points. First, our relationship, our overall trade relationship with Canada is probably the most successful in the world. That $662 billion you referred to going both ways is actually in balance, unlike what the president has said. We're in balance with Canada, as opposed to with China, for instance. There's always, no matter how successful the relationship is overall, there will always be irritants. And lumber is the longest-standing irritant in the relationship. I had to deal with it more than 20 years ago. Dairy is an irritant as well, and it's become a new irritant. So I think it's important to keep those things in context. The recent decision on dairy ingredients by Canada is a change in the status quo, And frankly, it has caused concern not only for the U.S., but also for Australia, New Zealand, the European Union, and Mexico. So it needs to be looked at. But we have to put these things in context rather than picking fights with the most important trade partner we have.
Do you think the Trump administration, by criticizing NAFTA, but creating a dispute and raising tensions, well, not creating a dispute, you say Canada moved first. Okay, I'll take that point. But these are commodities that are outside NAFTA. Dairy is outside NAFTA. Lumber is a codicil of NAFTA. To have this tension over these things that are outside NAFTA leaves the impression that NAFTA is in flames when, in fact, it isn't. And I'm wondering if it just creates needless tension. NAFTA is fine right now.
That's a great point. I think that these two irritants and these two issues that have to be dealt with would look a lot different if Mr. Trump hadn't declared war on NAFTA. I think what has happened, and we see it more dramatically, of course, with Mexico, Mr. Trump, as candidate and as coming in as president, has essentially demonized NAFTA and Mexico in a way that's been extremely damaging. He's hurt U.S.-Mexico relations to the point that we may well end up electing López Obrador, who is a virtual Marxist, to be president of Mexico next year. I think that as he's spoken to his advisors more and more and gotten into the job, he has toned down some of that rhetoric. But there's no doubt that his attacks on NAFTA have poisoned the well to some extent with Canada as well as Mexico.
And you could even say with Asia, although we don't want to get into that right now, but
the one thing I would say about Asia is anyone he talks to in the business community and anyone he talks to among his advisors would say to him, Mr. President, we have a major trade problem, and it's with China. It's not with Canada, and it's not with Mexico.
Can you respond to Yelnizian's notion that leaving the U.S. trade rep open in the Trump administration is a big problem?
I think it's a significant problem. Bob Lighthizer, the nominee, is a very experienced person. He's a hardliner on trade, but he's a realist as well. He understands the importance of NAFTA. And it would be very helpful if Bob, 100 days into this administration, were in office.
Ira Shapiro served as chief U.S. trade negotiator with Japan and Canada and as general counsel in the office of the U.S. trade representative during the Clinton administration. Right now, he's a senior advisor with the Albright Stonebridge Group. Ambassador, it's great to talk to you.
Thanks so much, John. I appreciate it.
We're going to cut taxes for businesses to make them competitive, and we're going to cut taxes for the American people, especially low and middle-income families.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It's a present still partially unwrapped, but certainly the people who will be most happy about the much-anticipated Trump administration tax cut know who they are at this point after today's formal announcements. Billed as the biggest tax cut in history, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, along with National Economic Director Gary Cohn, made the presentation earlier today.
Under the Trump plan, we will have a massive tax cut for businesses and massive tax reform and simplification.
It's a mix of well-known Trump campaign promises, persistent question marks, and future collisions with lawmakers on specifics, including the impact on the deficit. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick assesses whether it can pass Congress and has more on today's unveiling.
A tax cut was a major promise from President Trump when he was a candidate, and with Republicans in control on Capitol Hill, now is the time to go for it. Republicans are all in on the idea of major tax reform. Along with repealing Obamacare, though, it was the thing they planned to get done fast before the summer. Well, those plans have slowed down, and like with health care, getting Republicans to agree among themselves on what trillions in tax cuts should look like is not going to be easy. The centerpiece of the president's outline is a massive tax cut in corporate rates from 35% down to 15%. The idea here is to make the U.S. more competitive with countries where taxes are lower. Now, many corporations don't pay that 35% anyway because of loopholes and tax breaks, and Trump says he wants to close a lot of those too. The plan would also let more small businesses and non-corporate business entities get in on that low 15% rate. For individuals, it's less generous. Trump wants to collapse the current 7 income tax brackets down to 3. It's not clear yet what the income levels for those brackets are. The plan also gets rid of almost all itemized deductions except the mortgage interest deduction and the write-off for charitable contributions. It's also unclear whether the amount you can write off for those charitable contributions would stay the same or go down. The standard income deduction could go up. That would give middle-class families a tax break. Now, Democrats are unlikely to get on board with any of this plan, and Republicans are excited about the first chance in decades to rewrite the tax code and cut rates, especially at the top of the income scale. But Trump's proposal today is just that, an opening bid. It's Congress that has to cook up a policy, and that is hard. For starters, that 15% corporate rate, it's estimated to cost the federal government more than $2 trillion over 10 years. Even when you factor in economic growth, it's still a potential trillion-dollar hole in the deficit. And the estate tax, as Republicans want, and that hole gets even deeper. Some estimates have the total cost of the plan at $4 trillion. Here's Senator Ron Wyden. He's a Democrat from Oregon and a member of the Tax Writing Finance Committee.
Responsible bipartisan tax reform will generate growth and revenue, but it's not going to be fantasy numbers. It is not going to be fantasy revenue.
And Senate rules can make this job really hard, too. A procedure called budget reconciliation lets Republicans pass the tax plan with just 50 votes, no Democrats needed. But those same rules don't allow you to increase the deficit after 10 years. And that means that a huge corporate rate cut might have to sunset after just a decade. Companies hate that. Their lobbyists hate it. And so does House Speaker Paul Ryan. His top tax aide the other day called the idea of a 15% rate that isn't permanent a magic unicorn flying around. He said it can't be done. On top of that, Trump's plan jettisoned one of Paul Ryan's pet policies, a border tax on imports. Ryan wants that tax, but retailers like Walmart absolutely do not. Most Republicans do believe tax cuts spur the economy enough to make up for the lost revenue, digging that deficit hole, even though most recent economic history shows otherwise. Here's Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, a Republican, also on the Finance Committee.
Growth is the answer to getting that number down. So I don't want us to have a suboptimal tax reform because we think we have to be revenue neutral.
And there's where this fight is headed. Big deficits versus the big politics of a deep tax cut. No votes are expected in Congress until at least the fall. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington for The Takeaway.
What's a conversation about immigration sound like here in Buffalo? Well, we asked the trio of Buffalonians, Eva Hassett, an immigration resettlement activist, and Ayla Abiyad, who trained as an architect in Aleppo, Syria, of all places, in a peaceful country, imagining she would return. Well, she's now here for good. And Larry Crist, a local businessman in the high-end lighting trade. We asked them to imagine they were preparing a little quiet dinner for White House officials, or even the commander-in-chief himself, to try to get a Buffalo perspective on immigration into the national conversation. Well, this trio wouldn't stop talking. Eva knew right away how she would host the special guests.
I think for food, we take the International Institute's map for adventurous eaters, and we get something, which is a real thing, and we get something from each of the ethnic restaurants that are on that map for food. So we have as many different kinds of ethnic food as we possibly can. And I think we should ask everybody that comes to the dinner to talk about their ancestry, especially the people who were born here. You know, I have to say, I think about the rhetoric and this, you know, this hate stuff or whatever we're talking about with in terms of what is America. We have done this again and again and again. My name comes from my grandmother, who was Italian. The family, when they came here in the 1880s, was named Castelvici. But as soon as they got here, they changed it to Castine because Italians couldn't get a job. Italians were not welcome. You know, my father is Irish. Hassett is actually Irish. In the Hassett family, once the patriarch got here, Michael, he decreed there would be no boys named Michael or Patrick because Mick and Patty were slurs. My question always is, what are we going to learn? So I guess I would, back to the dinner, I would have us talk about, I would have each person talk a little bit about their story, their ancestry, and see if I couldn't get the conversation to be about when we're going to learn.
Who would you invite? Who would you invite? Who's important? Isla, who do you think should come?
I would be more than happy to, first of all, have like a personal conversation with whomever have fear or have concerns about immigrants and refugees. I would love to be on that dinner table myself, because I always feel like when people feel nervous when I introduce myself, hi, my name is Ayla, I'm from Syria. When they get scared, I really want to invite them to lunch and talk to them and tell them about myself and where I come from and tell them that, you know, Syrian people are not that scary. We all are normal people like you guys. We have dreams and hopes and fears. Most of us, we have 11 million displaced people internally and outside Syria, and most of us share one dream. I can tell you that for sure. We dream to be able to find a job and live next to people who, like our loved ones. Most of my friends and my family are scattered all over the globe. They're either struggling finding a job, or they're struggling because they're away from their families. So I would like to, on that dinner table, I would like to talk about that and tell that we contribute, we work, we pay taxes, and we contribute building our communities, hoping that this person leaving the table, I want to tell him that immigration and asylum and coming here as a refugee is an extremely difficult process.
That's definitely a good message for our guest. Larry, we want you to do the lighting, of course.
Of course, but of course.
More than that, would you give the president a piece of your mind, or would you be more subtle?
But I would have it at a refugee or immigrant's home.
That's a great idea.
And I would have them there to talk to the president. And I would allow him, hopefully, to make a judgment that I don't think he's experienced. And I'm assuming that that opportunity may change him, or what I perceive his view is. I would like to give him the opportunity to walk down a different direction that I perceive he's moving now.
You know, for me, it's a truism that you can't have a growing economy if you don't have a growing population. If you don't have a growing population, you don't have a growing workforce. So you don't have employees that employers can hire. If you don't have a growing population, you don't have customers for the businesses or consumers for the services. So those companies that sell product or provide services don't have anybody to sell them to. If you don't have a growing economy, you don't have homeowners. So you can't have strong neighborhoods. If you don't have a growing population, you don't have taxpayers. So the government that has to provide public safety services and infrastructure services doesn't have the money that it needs to do that. So in order to grow your economy, you need to grow your population. What we know nationally, and it's also true in Buffalo, is that the fastest growing population is the immigrant population. And in Buffalo, for as long as I've been alive, every 10 years when we have the census, we all kind of wait to hear how many people, how much smaller we are, how many people have left. But what we're beginning to see, and it hasn't turned around yet in Buffalo, but it's turned around in a lot of places in this country, is that the immigrant population is growing so fast that it is outpacing the shrinkage in the native-born population. And so in Buffalo, I think between 2000 and 2014, the immigrant population grew by more than 32%. The native-born population shrank by 5%. Mm. And so while we're still shrinking, we're shrinking more slowly. And the mayor of Buffalo is saying that he's projecting a change to growth in the 2020 census, which I think is going to be the first time in 70 years that the city has grown. And that will be because of immigrants. So you can't grow your population without immigrants, and you can't grow your economy without population.
Let's just march over and talk to Larry here. You have found that your workforce – can really take advantage of some of the things that Eva is talking about here. How does it work on the factory floor? How do people assimilate? And is there a sense of community among people who come from these faraway places and have these stories, and regular Buffalonians who eat wings and are heartbroken by the Bills and can't get away from the Buffalo Sabres?
Well, on the factory floor, we really can't help the Bills, but we can try to make great lighting. But the amazing part is that we have people that come with a global view, a diversity, a different religion, that have broadened our perspective, provincial Buffalo's perspective about the world. We do business around the globe, and it's helped us. And then the amazing overflow of help from our employees, where they've taken pride in our city. They will help somebody. Somebody needs furniture. Somebody needs clothing. Somebody needs to learn the bus system better. All that wells up, and we become a team, a different team, a multicultural team.
Ayla, where is that part of your mission of giving back to Syria? I would say you studied architecture in Aleppo. Without speaking about the difficulties now and the horrible sense that there really still is no light at the end of the tunnel for the Civil War, at some point, there's going to be a lot of architecture to do in Aleppo. Mm-hmm. You think about that?
Of course, all the time. I daydream about going back to my country, even though Buffalo is now my second home. I lived a third of my life in Buffalo now. It's been since 2009, so you do the math about my age. So I always dream about going and give back to my country, and I believe at some point there will be a lot of opportunity to rebuild, because you see the horrible, heartbreaking pictures of, like, destroyed infrastructure, leveled neighborhoods. How is that going to happen and when? This is a big question mark in my head. I don't have an answer. I don't believe any political leader or anything that have a straightforward answer to what's going to happen and when in Syria. This is why my plan is to give back to Buffalo, because I feel Buffalo like gave me back my wings, and now I feel I can do anything. And as part of that, I try as much as I can to contribute building my community. In my case, literally like doing buildings and designs. I try to give back to the community, like the International Institute. I try to volunteer my time to help newly coming refugees and Syrian family to integrate faster, because I believe the faster refugees and immigrants integrate, the faster they can give back. And I believe that the International Institute and Buffalo in general, there's a lot going on in that effort, and I appreciate that. My son is Buffalonian, so I don't know if I'm when I would be going back.
You know, it's a troublesome identity now. I think, you know, if you think of the George W. Bush years and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, during the Obama years, we've had a war in Yemen, and, you know, in many ways, we're helping to sustain a famine in Yemen, and Americans don't really know about that, but yet there are millions of people who see the consequences of our foreign policy. You travel all over the world. Your products are in museums and places all over the world. It sounds like your workforce is getting the benefit of this sort of out-of-the-bubble expertise that immigrants give. I mean, I'm wondering if that helps your business.
I think we haven't used it as a selling point. Hopefully it would bubble up from who we are and what we stand for. I must say, in traveling around the world, the hardest explanation I have is explaining what direction America is headed. They understand my company, its functions, but where we stand is as a country. So I think I owe it to those that I'm involved with at home and those customers that I talk to. I need to tell them what we stand for.
That was our conversation with three Buffalonians: Eva Hassett, Executive Director of the International Institute of Buffalo, architect Ayla Abiad from Syria, and Larry Crist, Chief Operating Officer of Light Lab Corporation.
The Takeaway is supported by Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, a Netflix original documentary series from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis, the women who brought you the critically acclaimed film Hot Girls Wanted. The series explores the intersection of sex and technology in a digital age and covers six true stories inside a world that is faking it. A 2017 Sundance Film Festival official selection, Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
Like every nation, the United States has a right to control who enters our country and to keep out those who would do us harm.
Round one was an aggressive Trump roundup and deportation policy. Round two was some U.S. cities pledging to resist Trump enforcement on their territory. Round three, Trump says federal money will be withheld from so-called sanctuary cities. And round four, this week, a San Francisco judge blocked that punitive measure withholding funds from sanctuary cities in ways that violate the Constitution, although cities that have been explicitly warned by the Justice Department may have to comply. The court's decision on Tuesday is yet another left hook for the Trump administration's immigration policies, with implications in every U.S. jurisdiction. Minneapolis is one of these sanctuary cities that did not receive an explicit warning from the Justice Department. But Minneapolis Mayor Betsy Hodges, who I spoke with last year, says she doesn't want the feds overruling her own peace officers.
We have had an ordinance since 2003 in Minneapolis that our police officers aren't going to do the work of the federal immigration folks, that it is a question of public safety, because if immigrant folks, if anybody doesn't feel safe calling the police, if witnesses to crime, if victims of crime can't call the police and feel safe, then we are a less safe city overall.
With an on-the-scene report of how one city is dealing with round four in the immigration dispute, Minnesota Public Radio's Brant Williams has more.
The third paragraph of the president's immigration order starts like this, quote, "Sanctuary jurisdictions across the United States willfully violate federal law in an attempt to shield aliens from removal from the United States." The order also says the government has the authority to define what a sanctuary jurisdiction is and then punish cities and counties for, as the order states, shielding aliens from removal. Minneapolis officials don't use the term sanctuary city.
There is no common definition of what is a sanctuary city. The city of Minneapolis has what we call a separation ordinance.
Minneapolis City Attorney Susan Siegel says that ordinance, passed in 2003, prohibits police and other city employees from asking about the immigration status of people they come into contact with.
Unless it's clearly relevant to a crime being investigated by law enforcement, or it's a requirement of a particular program. For example, all employers are required to obtain I-9 forms as part of the hiring process. So that would be an exception to our ordinance.
While Siegel believes the city doesn't fall under the executive order's definition of a sanctuary city, there are still concerns about what happens next, mainly the fear factor among immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers living in the city. Minneapolis City Council Vice President Elizabeth Glidden says one of the main priorities for the city will be to reach out to residents who've come to Minneapolis from troubled countries.
Compared with other metropolitan areas, we do have a large number of people here who are here because they have been fleeing danger in their home countries. And the technical words are often asylees or refugees.
The countries those people are fleeing from are often places where corruption and abuse by government and law enforcement officials run rampant. So in the wake of an order which critics say threatens to blur the line between local and federal government and law enforcement, Glidden and others are trying to find ways to assure immigrants and refugees that they can trust city government.
We have the largest Somali American community in the United States, and this is a country that has seen unrest, that has seen the collapse of the government state, and people who have come here from Somalia have experienced that we can't even understand.
Glidden helped create a city task force, which began working in February. The group recently presented an update to the city council, which suggested the city create a legal defense fund for people fighting deportation. The other big worry for city leaders is that Minneapolis may be included in the administration's list of jurisdictions that are slated to be defunded. About $26 million, or 2% of Minneapolis's 2017 budget, comes from federal funds. The bulk of that, nearly $15 million, comes to the city in the form of grants targeted to fund a variety of programs, including community crime prevention, job training, and housing. The Minneapolis Police Department also receives about $1 million a year from the Department of Justice for a number of different public safety programs. The money is a fraction of the department's total budget. However, U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has warned that those dollars could also be withheld. Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Harto said the impact of losing that money would be significant.
But I want to assure people that I don't believe, and the city of Minneapolis, we are not going to change the way we do business. It is not the role of local law enforcement to conduct immigration enforcement. We need the people in our communities. We need to have those relationships.
Harto is speaking to an audience of several hundred people at a forum on police-community relations hosted by Minnesota Public Radio. She said that when police are seen as agents of immigration enforcement, members of immigrant communities become less likely to reach out to report crimes, and that can leave many to live in fear and in silence. The Department of Homeland Security is already acting on the president's order. Recently, Immigration Customs Enforcement, commonly referred to as ICE, put the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office on a list of non-cooperative agencies. ICE claimed the Sheriff's Office put two Mexican nationals jailed for criminal offenses back on the streets despite a hold request. At a press conference, Hennepin County Sheriff Rich Stanek presented pictures showing the two men being released into ICE custody. The sheriff reiterated how he handles any hold requests from the agency.
If ICE wishes a person to remain in custody beyond the time that he or she is scheduled for release, they must get a court order or they must pick that person up at the time of his or her release from the jail.
Stanek also said for him to hold someone without a judicial order is against the law, and he asked for an apology from ICE. An ICE spokesman didn't apologize, but did say that the order allows local law enforcement to legally hold people like the two Mexican nationals for 48 hours. It's not clear if the most significant impact from the president's executive order on immigration enforcement will be to the city's coffers or its immigrant and refugee communities. Minneapolis city leaders appear to be preparing for both. For The Takeaway, I'm Brant Williams in Minneapolis.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Finally, three more people on top of the two inmates already executed this week will be put to death in Arkansas. Basically, the idea is three people have to die before the expiration date on one of the drugs, midazolam, that will kill them. But in this ongoing battle within the criminal justice system, the American Medical Association ban on doctor participation in executions has come under question. Dr. Sandeep Johar, after much thinking, disagrees with the AMA's view. He's a cardiologist and author of the books Intern and Doctored. In an op-ed for the New York Times, Dr. Johar states that although he opposes capital punishment, he believes doctors have an important role at executions.
When physicians don't participate, because, you know, prison wardens typically can't put in IVs or mixed drugs, they get EMTs, paramedics, sometimes nurses, sometimes just phlebotomists to do the procedure. And it's not clear, and it's very unlikely that a professional like a phlebotomist would have the familiarity with the drugs or with the protocol to do the procedure in an effective way.
You talk about palliative value of a doctor's presence. And you write, no one would object to a doctor providing comfort, spiritual or narcotic, to a terminally ill patient at the hour of death. It is not a stretch to think of death row inmates who have exhausted their appeals as having a terminal disease with 100% mortality. I read that, and in fact, that is a huge stretch. I mean, this is someone who's being killed by the state. I mean, it seems that kind of stretch could be applied, you know, in the Holocaust.
This is clearly, you know, an issue that's complex, and I can see both sides of the issue. But the doctors in the Holocaust were trying to facilitate, in many cases, torture. The doctors at Guantanamo were facilitating the torture of individuals by the state. Here, I'm advocating something very different. I'm saying that if a prisoner requests a physician to be present, and a physician agrees to be present to help facilitate the execution and to reduce the risk of suffering, then preventing that physician from doing so, ironically, would make one complicit in the torture of a prisoner. I think that with the number of executions that have gone awry in this country because of the inadequate training of prison personnel, I think that it's reasonable to allow a physician who wants to participate for the express purpose of reducing the suffering of a prisoner at his hour of death to do so.
As you speak, it occurs to me, why not, rather than force a doctor or, you know, encourage a doctor or invite a doctor or allow a doctor to just witness something and, you know, toss in something from the sidelines that might be palliative or help if things go awry, maybe there should be a way of actually legally allowing a doctor under certain circumstances that are explicit to veto an execution, that something about the state of the prisoner mentally, psychologically, whatever is just at that moment, the doctor could say, no, you know, we're not proceeding here. And that basically prison officials would have to allow that and it could go back to court, but a doctor would have some power.
You know, my fundamental belief, as I expressed in the article, is one that's totally against capital punishment. And so anything that would prevent a prisoner from being executed, I would be totally in support of. But the reality is that these prisoners have unfortunately exhausted their appeals, and a last-minute assessment by a physician about to inject is unlikely going to change the subsequent course of the execution. If it could, I would be very much in support of that. But as it is today, most likely a physician who wants to participate, and hopefully it would be to want to participate to ensure that the prisoner doesn't suffer unduly. If a doctor wants to participate, they typically would participate by inserting the IV line, mixing the drug, and then being available if the drugs didn't have the intended effect. Most physicians will not actually be injecting the drug. That would be done by the prison warden or other prison personnel. Mm. The physician would be witnessing it and then be available to provide palliation if, as in so many cases, the execution doesn't go as planned.
You know, just extending on that, since so many death row cases are so long after the crime is committed, even with people who've exhausted their appeals, you're so far removed from a speedy justice in the way that we understand it in legal terms. And since there is a prescription against cruel and unusual punishment in the Constitution, maybe the Supreme Court, who rules on this as a general matter, is not the best place to rule on it. That maybe far from the event, it's more of a medical judgment whether something is cruel and unusual. And perhaps it's possible to medicalize this event and that would be of some value, although I could see it being very, very painful for doctors to up their level of participation in something like this. But do you know any doctors who are pro-capital punishment?
Oh, I know many doctors who are. I mean, there's a spectrum of political beliefs in the medical profession. Many doctors are quite conservative in their political beliefs and also support capital punishment. But I think that the more likely scenario is that if physicians refuse to participate and refuse to be present, and state statutes require physician participation at injections, and some require only physician participation, and if a physician is not willing to be present, then it's more likely that the state will not cancel the execution, but will change the method of execution to one that doesn't require a person with medical expertise, such as death by firing squad or electrocution. So I think that's, unfortunately, the more likely political scenario, as much as I would want the other way.
Dr. Johar, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Sandeep Johar is a cardiologist, author of the books Intern and Doctor, and a contributing opinion writer at the New York Times. His latest piece, Why It's Okay for Doctors to Participate in Executions, ran on April 21st.
My pledge is that in the first 100 days of my administration...
Today marks our 100th day of working together for the American people.
100 days since I took the oath of office.
What follows is my 100-day action plan to make America great again.
100 days, 100 nights, to know a man's heart.
100 days of Trump in office. It's not exactly an epic novel, but the White House has to face a measure of what got done in those first 100 days. Good idea?
This is Joanne from Bend, Oregon. I think the first 100 days is very significant because it's a good indicator of a president's temperament, priorities, and ability to get projects and things done. Climate change is at the top of my list for President Trump because it is truly the issue of our time. I can't think of any other issue, policy, or law that can absolutely impact every single citizen of the United States.
Or the world, for that matter. Thanks so much for your reactions to this question on the 100 days. Give us your thoughts. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And thanks so much to WBFO in Buffalo, New York, for hosting us these last 2 days. Thanks so much to you for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.